Blog Talk Radio.
See that? So Corin moved to Chicago a while ago now, and we took a little break because he was getting like all situated and relaxed over there. He visited New York this weekend. We did a quick podcast that's up on the YouTube channel if you haven't seen it yet. And I think we're good to continue it. And he's gone. He's in Vegas this weekend and Montreal next weekend. But after that, then we're good to keep it going. And you guys lucked out, man, because anybody who listens to that podcast knows that from day one I was saying, I don't want it to be on fucking camera. I'm tired of being on camera. I'm on camera 5 days a week. I feel pressure to, like, gel my hair and look like a decent human being. I wanted that to be, like, on the weekends as I'm fucking wearing sweatpants and I got a hat on and my face is all scruffy. I do the podcast then and I don't give a shit about how I look. Well, we're so stupid we couldn't figure out how to do it, like, just audio. So we're just going to do it Skype and say fuck it. And we also got some better USB mics for that, too. So anyway, long story short, as you can tell, it's really not short at all because I'm dragging on. But the podcast is back, so be excited about that. The next one, like I said, will probably be in like 3 weeks. You could check out the one we did yesterday on the YouTube channel. And with that being said, sweet Jesus, I got a lot of great stuff to talk about today. So we got Chris Christie involved in only the most embarrassing scandal I've ever seen in my life. I'm going to kick it off with that in a second because it's just that funny. Marco Rubio thinks we should look at action movies to figure out what kind of foreign policy we should have because, you know, that can't go wrong. Jeb Bush is basically saying, www.IAgreeWithEverythingGeorgeWBushDidOnForeignPolicy.com. That's a long www, but you get the gist. We'll talk about that. George Clooney endorses somebody for president. I got a whole bunch of Ben Carson today. I got like three separate Ben Carson stories because they're all just that funny, and he's just that bad at running for president. Mike Huckabee a little bit. Later on in the show, some awesome hypocrisy on the issue of free speech. Everybody who was screaming, you know, free speech on the issue of Muhammad cartoons, rightfully so, by the way, I agree with them 100%, and I was one of the people who was out there screaming every day that this isn't a debatable issue, you have that freedom of speech. Well, I hear fucking crickets when it comes to free speech for a different issue, and I'm not going to spoil it now, but later on you'll see exactly what I'm talking about. Michelle Obama gave a fantastic speech on race, man. It was amazing. So we're going to play a clip of that for you guys, and then we'll break it down a little bit. That'll be later on in the show. So let's go ahead and get started here, and we'll kick it off with this Chris Christie story so we could all laugh. It's times like right now that I wish I actually was a stand-up comedian because there's so many directions you could go. There's so many jokes you can make with this story. I know Bill Maher's going to have a field day with this. Jon Stewart's going to have a field day with this. Jimmy Dore's going to have a field day with this. All right, here we go. So we recently learned that Chris Christie was essentially doing pay-to-play for his pensions in New Jersey. So his buddies and his donors got giant sums of money while the workers got screwed. He basically redirected pension funds to his friends. It's a clear case of corruption, but of course in America in 2015, corruption usually doesn't get punished, unfortunately. So we have an even more embarrassing scandal to discuss today. Huffington Post reports, quote, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie spent more than $82,000 in taxpayer money on concessions at NFL games, a sum that Republicans later reimbursed to the state treasury to avoid impropriety. They were so embarrassed that they reimbursed the money. but we're still not done. They say, according to a New Jersey watchdog analysis of records from the governor's office that was published Monday, Christie used $300,000 of his $360,000 state allowance over 5 years to purchase food, alcohol, and desserts. Some $82,594 of that sum went to Delaware North Sports Service, which operates the concessions at MetLife Stadium, the home of both the New York Giants and Jets teams. Oh my goodness! So understand exactly what they're saying here. They're saying that about $83,000 of the money went specifically for concessions for sporting events, so while he was at the sporting events. And then $300,000 in general, so not just at sporting events, but $300,000 out of $360,000 in the allowance went to food. So $300,000 out of $360,000, he was going around buying alcohol and desserts and food and stuff, whether it's at actual sporting events or outside of sporting events. They say that there was a specific supermarket that he would get a lot of the stuff at. $300,000 out of $360,000 went to food. Come on, man. What are you doing? Like, you would think that somebody would be self-aware enough, especially if you're in the public spotlight all the time. Like, you would be self-aware enough to understand what the stereotypes are that are associated with really overweight guys from New Jersey. Like, you would think that you would maybe walk on eggshells and try to put forward this idea that you're not the embodiment of the gluttonous stereotype. But Chris Christie's like, fuck that, man. I love my food. I love my alcohol. I love going to sporting events. And then there was, remember, there were other stories of corruption where he was in, what is it, the Dallas Cowboys owner's box or something like that? Every time I say that sentence, somebody in somebody's box, I can't help but giggle because apparently I'm 14 years old. But, I mean, Chris Christie, look, it just shows you he's the perfect example of old-school-style, brazenly corrupt politics. He's part of the good old boys club. And he doesn't give a fuck about how he looks to other people, even though he goes around screaming about small government. So here's a guy who screams about fiscal discipline and talks about how, you know, you have to be more responsible with taxpayer money if you're a leader, if you are a politician. You have to make sure that, you know, you don't overspend, that all the typical right-wing douchebag talking points that we've heard forever. But this guy turns around, not only does he spend big money, he's also spending it on things that are the most easily mockable things when you're a dude who used to weigh 476 fucking pounds. Chris, what are you doing? I don't know what else to say to you. Do you not have a head? Do you not have a brain? And for the media here, how many scandals have to involve Chris Christie before you guys finally go, okay, you know what? We're done with this guy. Let's move along to the next contender and give somebody else who wants to run for president more spotlight and a fairer shake, at better coverage. Because with Chris Christie, it doesn't matter how many things he's been involved with, they're always... Chris Christie, one of the front runners. They always treat him like, oh, that's how he is. He's a likable guy. He's a straight shooter. How's he a straight shooter? Mr. talking about small government, but then spending $300,000 on fucking Frito-Lays and Heinekens. Are you kidding me? Remember, this is also the guy, forget the Bridgegate scandal, because we all know about that inside and out. This is the guy who gave FEMA money for Hurricane Sandy. He gave it to people based on how many favors they did for him. So there were some mayors of some areas that were harder hit by Sandy, and they got less money than people who were more inland and had less damage, but there were Republican mayors who did more favors for Chris Christie. So if you helped Chris Christie, then he would give you your disaster relief. If you weren't on his team, then he would give you less money or no money at all. This is also a guy who gave his political donor buddies pieces of the World Trade Center. Who does that? That, like, you're literally profiting in that case off of a terrorist attack. You're like, I'll take this and I'll give this to, you know, my donors. Here's a piece of the World Trade Centers that collapsed during the terrorist attack. Thank you for donating to me. Here's a part of floor number 16. Again, do you have no sense of self-perception? Here you are. You're viewed as this gluttonous guy who can't control himself. And you're out $300,000 of the $360,000 allowance is going for you to get fatter. You know, you're giving away pieces of the World Trade Center building, and you think that's cool? You think that when people hear about that, they're going to go, oh, that's Chris Christie. That's my guy right there. No, we're all going to be, yuck, look at this guy. What a disgusting insider political sleazeball that we're dealing with here. So, I don't know. You guys tell me, is this going to be one of the scandals that blows up? The only one that really blew up was Bridgegate. And that was actually the least extreme scandal. I think the other ones were much worse. But for whatever reason, that one got more coverage. Hopefully, I don't care which one of these blows up. Just let's have another blow up, because these really help put into perspective more what kind of a human being that we're dealing with. And this is not a human being that gives a fuck about the people of New Jersey or would give a fuck about the people of the United States of America if he were president. Okay. Now we go to Marco Rubio. $300,000 for him and his buddies to get fat. You gotta know, dude. You gotta understand that's not acceptable. What are you doing? All right, we got a clip here from Marco Rubio. So, Marco Rubio was at a Republican event in South Carolina, and he explained what kind of foreign policy he favors.
And perhaps as important as anything else, by rallying the world not just to contain radical jihadists, but to defeat them. And people ask, what should our strategy be on global jihadists and terrorists? I refer them to the movie Taken. Have you seen the movie Taken? Liam Neeson? He has a line, and this is what our strategy should be. We will look for you, we will find you, and we will kill you.
Okay, he's serious. He's not kidding. Now, oftentimes on this show, we jokingly discuss the Republican Party and what their views are on foreign policy. And I've said things along the lines of, well, you know, the real world isn't a Chuck Norris movie. The real world isn't a cheesy 1990s Steven Seagal flick. That's not how it works. And, you know, it's tongue-in-cheek, it's ha-ha, I'm partially serious, but of course partially joking, because in my mind, I think, well, I may disagree with the Republicans, but they're not dumb enough to really think the world is like that, right? Where it's Steven Seagal, and he's taking on 100 bad guys, and somehow wins, and it's pure good versus pure evil. I mean, they're not that silly, right? Well, he just shows you right here. Turns out they do believe that. They absolutely believe that. His face was stone-cold serious when he said that, and the audience started cheering. Yeah, that's right, we're a good guy, we're like Liam Neeson, and everybody else like the bad guy, that's how the world works, there's no nuance, man, there's no shades of gray, oh, all right, yeah. If that's the view you have of the world that we live in, you're not qualified to be a fucking manager at an Arby's, okay? That's so mind-numbingly simplistic. So here are a few questions for Marco Rubio. Because, again, I think he really believes it. You tell me. You saw his face. You saw the way he made that point. So, look, what we need to do is kill the terrorists. That's our foreign policy goal. That's what we do. We kill the terrorists. It's where the good guys are the bad guys. Okay, Marco, where? Where do we kill them? That's question number one. Where do we kill them?
We should keep killing them in Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria and Somalia and Yemen and Pakistan.
Why not go further out? I mean, you just said, let's kill the terrorists. There are terrorists in Mali. Should we invade Mali? There are terrorists in Libya. Should we invade Libya? There's jihadist organizations in Indonesia. Should we invade Indonesia? We heard the other day there's slave labor going on in Malaysia. Should we invade Malaysia? I mean, you want me to continue here? How about all the people who were terrorists that were essentially on our side and are on our side? Especially during the Cold War, we supported a plethora of fascist dictators all around the world because we viewed them as like, oh, at least they're not communists, so let's support the fascist guys. And we still support dictators to this day. So, when you say, let's kill the terrorists, what does that mean? What does that mean? How about, you know, like in Brunei, for example, which is our ally who we just put in the TPP deal. They just implemented Sharia law. wouldn't that be considered terrorism? Because when they put Sharia law into place in Afghanistan, we went after the Taliban ruthlessly. And Al-Qaeda, of course, who at the time was embedded in the region. So if we can fight to stop Sharia in Afghanistan, why wouldn't we fight to stop it in Brunei? Do you want to continue going down this road? There's a 150 different countries where you can say, okay, that person's a terrorist, that person's a terrorist. So it's no longer the case that the way war works is, hey, there's one place, one country's army, we are officially at war with them, one nation versus another nation. It no longer works like that. In Marco Rubio's world, he said, we kill the terrorists, just like Liam Neeson. We find them, we kill them, and that's it. So then why wouldn't we? Should we put drone armies all throughout Africa, all throughout the Middle East? Why not? Look, there are some terrorism cells in Europe, for example. There's some pockets of radical Islam. Do you want to drone certain areas of France while we're at it? Hey, while we're at it, why not? Why would we stop there? Why not do droning in the United States of America? Because if you only care, are they terrorists? They're terrorists. Let's go after them. So then why would we limit it to just Islamic terrorists? There are groups. We covered a neo-Nazi group in northern Florida that was just busted up recently. We've spoken about sovereign citizens in the United States of America who have done attacks like on the Georgia courthouse. How about different KKK chapters in America? There's hundreds of them. So why not continue our drone warfare here? Have a flying robot army of death that we have the base in Alabama, and every once in a while they do a run to Idaho and blow up a few acres with some people in there who we think are bad guys. This is your view of the world? This is how we act? And by the way, what happens when we're the terrorists? What about that? What about when there's some guy operating a drone in Las Vegas, and that person blows up the wrong people in Pakistan? I mean, we've covered stories where they made the choice to kill people at Taliban operatives' funerals, knowing there were women and children there. But they figured, well, look, it's a Taliban operative's funeral. There's going to be other Taliban guys there. So we don't care that we're going to kill women and children in the process. So let's just blow it up anyway. When they blew up a grandma picking vegetables in a field in, I believe it was Pakistan, when they blew up a wedding procession, these are all stories that we've reported on, and there's a variety of them. They happen all the time. How about when we just killed an American civilian and an Italian civilian who were hostages by Al-Qaeda? By your own logic, well, we got to get the terrorists when they're acting bad. Well, then why wouldn't you authorize an attack on our own guys who are operating the drones in Las Vegas? They are terrorists, right? They killed civilians for a political reason, a political ideology. That's the textbook definition of terrorism. Or do you think, oh, when we do it, it's okay? I'm sure you're in that camp, right? But why would you draw these lines when you made very clear right there in your speech, this is apparently a Liam Neeson movie, where we go get the bad guys. That's what we do. Well, there's a lot of bad guys all over the fucking place, man. A lot of the bad guys are our allies, right? Would this guy support doing a drone strike on Bibi Netanyahu when he slaughters civilians in Gaza? How about that? Oh, you wouldn't do that, right? Well, again, because when we do it, we're the good guys by definition, so it's okay. So essentially what he's talking about is give us, the United States government, a green light to kill whoever we want, whenever we want, and you can't come after us through the international court, through any legal system or any legal process at all, and we get to continue to do terror on others. And you have no recourse. We get to do whatever we want to everybody else, and they can't do anything to us. Well, then I asked Marco Rubio, who really are the bad guys and who really are the good guys in that scenario? Now, see, this is the problem with this style of ultra-conservative thinking. It's stupid. It's stupid. I mean, you boil it down to what it is, and you take a look at, logically speaking, what it amounts to, and you go, oh, we're dealing with fucking simpletons here. We're dealing with people who don't look at the world in an objective way, who don't think that actions matter over tribalism and ideology. These are people who are not fit. Not only not to be politicians, they're not fit, like I said before, to be a manager at Arby's. And I still think that's disrespectful to managers at Arby's, because I'd rather have those guys running the system than somebody like Marco Rubio, who continually makes an ass of himself and seriously thinks that foreign policy and world affairs can be boiled down to a fucking Liam Neeson movie. I got more heated there than I thought I would. All right, let's go to Jeb Bush. Huh, I might get even more heated now. Well, actually, I kind of want to... I'm trying to think if I should do the George Clooney one first, because I might want to spend some time. Yeah, I'm going to want to spend some more time on the Jeb Bush one. So let's go to Clooney. Then we'll do Jeb Bush right after we come back from the first break, I promise. But let's go to Clooney. George Clooney endorsed a presidential candidate here. Perhaps this is unsurprising, but here he is with Fusion TV's Jorge Ramos, and they're talking about Hillary Clinton.
I think she's in town, by the way.
She is?
Yeah. Are you gonna
you'll know because all the traffic will be stopped.
Well, maybe it's because of you. But are you going to be helping her for 2016?
Sure. And whatever she wants, whatever way I can help. I think that she's a tremendous candidate, and I think she would be. I know her, and I think the world of her, and I think that I would be very happy if she were president.
You said in 2008 that she was the most polarizing figure in American politics.
She was a polarizing figure in American politics because at the time, there I felt that there were as many people that wouldn't show up to vote against her because she was Hillary, and that for whatever reason they'd been designing that for quite some time. You know, there've been a lot of pieces brought up that you know, were just brought up because they knew she was going to run for president later, and they tried to make them in. You know, Benghazi is this great scandal. Well, it's not. So I find that she is now, I think she's ready to be president. I think she could have been a wonderful president before.
Okay. I have no problem at all with George Clooney. He's a smart guy, and he's a great guy. But here's my question. What would happen if all A-list celebrities who are Democrats endorsed Bernie Sanders? That's my question. And I'm not asking that in a way as if to suggest, like, aha, I know what the answer is and it's a loaded question. No, I'm genuinely posing the question. Is it possible that if A-list celebrities essentially boosted up Bernie Sanders and let everybody know, like, no, this guy's really looking out for you, that he would have an even better chance of getting through the primary and possibly being the next president? If I had to guess, I would say yes, that would help, even if it's only a little bump. And it might even be a big bump. I do think it would help. I mean, it's possible that the establishment hates him so much that they'll tear him down no matter what. But as I've argued for a long time on this show, I think that celebrities don't even realize how much power they have. Like, some celebrities, like George Clooney, look at politicians and they're like, oh, look at these guys are really influential. But what George does understand is like, dude, more people know who you are than, what, some random senator from Nebraska. No, I mean, no disrespect to any senator in Nebraska. I'm just saying, we all know more people would recognize George Clooney than recognize that guy. I would recognize George Clooney more than I recognize that guy, and I follow politics for a living. So I don't think, you know, people like Ellen, for example, and she's done some great things politically. I love the few segments she's done on it. I fucking applaud her. She did some great stuff. But what I want, I would love it if these guys got more involved in politics, and if these guys didn't just play that standard celebrity Hollywood game of like, we're going to support the Democrat and we're going to support the most popular or most well-known establishment corporatist Democrat. And I don't know why they do it. Could it be that they know a lot of the same people and they rub elbows at the same parties and, you know, they're just all part of that exclusive A-list world? Maybe that has something to do with it. I don't know. Or maybe it's the case that these guys really think, like a lot of Democrats unfortunately do in the country, they just associate Hillary Clinton with like, oh, she's the next in line and, you know, nobody else should get in the way of that. Or they might actually think that she's more progressive than she really is. But whatever the case is, I really hope this is wishful thinking and this may be naive of me, but I just hope that all these big-time celebrities, whether it's George Clooney or Jay-Z, Beyonce. I saw the other day Ja Rule, not that he's a celebrity anymore. Maybe in 2003 that would have been the case. But he said he endorses Hillary Clinton. The more I read those headlines, I'm like, look, if you're going to endorse Hillary, at least wait until if/when she gets through the primary. You know, because then it's like, what are we going to do? It seems like there's very little other choice here. So, okay, whatever, we give up. We'll endorse Hillary. But in the primary process, why not endorse the most progressive candidate and try to get their status up and get their name recognition up more and force the media to cover them more? I really do think that whatever celebrity you want to talk about, whether it's an actor or, a singer or whatever, sports stars, whatever. I really wish that all of them would just get in line behind the person who's really going to stand up for all the right things that would be good for the American people. And I saw the stories, man. There was a list of all of the donors that gave to Bernie Sanders when he initially launched his campaign. The average donation was like $43 or something like that, right? Compare that to Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton's got corporate America falling all over themselves, giving her a tremendous amount of money. She's got Wall Street giving her a tremendous amount of money. Who do you think she's going to represent? Whereas Bernie Sanders was taking money from, you know, union, not even leaders, unions themselves, like the union workers. He was accepting money from teachers, just regular people who were like, damn, this guy might actually represent us. So they went and they gave money to him. I mean, he really is a guy that's about the American people and who cares about democracy and who actually would implement policies that we all favor, like raising the minimum wage and trying to get single payer and getting us out of useless wars. So in a way, I guess I'm kind of pleading a little bit here, but any A-list celebrities, the two of you or three of you maybe, who might watch this show or somebody might send you a link or some shit, please, for fuck's sake, stand up, endorse Bernie Sanders, and let's really try to push America in a progressive direction. Because if you notice, we had somebody who was a centrist Democrat, Barack Obama, for a while in office now. And what do we get? A little bit of change here and there. You know, we prevented the Great Depression, which is great. And we got Obamacare, which is a step in the right direction. But by and large, he's very similar to Bill Clinton, and he is very centrist and very corporatist, and a lot of what Obama does is business as usual. So let's not get a third Obama term with Hillary Clinton. Let's get something better. Let's get the next FDR term with Bernie Sanders. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, Jeb Bush makes an ass of himself, and then I got 312 different Ben Carson stories. Buckle up for that. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
back, guys.
And Jeb Bush is about to get his fucking ass whooped.
You about to find out. All right, here we go. Jeb Bush was asked by Megyn Kelly if he would have done the Iraq War, and his answer is pretty depressing.
On the subject of Iraq,
yep.
Honestly very controversial, knowing what we know now, would you have authorized the invasion?
I would have, and so would have Hillary Clinton, just to remind everybody, and so would have almost everybody that was confronted with the intelligence they got.
You don't think it was a mistake?
In retrospect, the intelligence that everybody saw, that the world saw, not just the United States, was faulty. And in retrospect, once we invaded and took out Saddam Hussein, we didn't focus on security first. And the Iraqis, in this incredibly insecure environment, turned on the United States military because there was no security for themselves and their families. By the way, guess who thinks that those mistakes took place as well? George W. Bush.
Your brother.
Yeah, I mean, so just for the newsflash to the world, if they're trying to find places where there's big space between me and my brother, this might not be one of those.
Well, isn't that lovely? So at the beginning, let's be very clear here, I wrote it down verbatim, quote, knowing what we know now, would you have authorized the invasion? Speaking, of course, about Iraq. The answer is, I would have. Then he follows up with, and Hillary Clinton and John Kerry and this and blah, 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 and oh, there's not much space between me and my brother on this one. This isn't an area where we disagree. Well, thank you. Thank you for telling us that even in 2015, you support arguably the biggest foreign policy blunder in American history. I mean, this is right up there with Vietnam. Now, understand, even the part that he went on about the intelligence community, this and that, and this and that, and this and that, and this and that. It's not true that, well, the intelligence community agreed across the board, and what were we going to do? I mean, we didn't have a choice. The intelligence community said X, so we just believed X. No. If you've looked at any of the investigative reporting on this, any documentaries on this, you know very clearly that, of course, there was dissent within the intelligence community. All the people, though, that dissented were just pushed to the side. Why? Because they wanted to go into Iraq. So they were cherry-picking stuff and saying, see, this is what we should focus on, this. Forget the other guy who's saying that none of this is true. Let's only focus on this. So, in essence, you have the Bush administration feeding the intelligence to the intelligence people, and then the intelligence people saying, right back to the Bush administration, ditto what you said. Let's go with that. So, no, it's not the case. What were we going to do? It was inevitable. Of course it wasn't inevitable. And by the way, even if you believe the bullshit intelligence, what was the bullshit intelligence? We think Saddam maybe is creating nuclear weapons. They didn't even bother to try to connect that last dot to say, when he creates them, he's going to use them on America. They just assumed that was the case. And that's probably the biggest bullshit part of their argument. Like, what? You do know Saddam's a Baathist, right? He's not some crazy fundamentalist who thinks he's getting 72 virgins. This is a guy who is a secular dictator. He's not a good guy by any stretch of the imagination. But he knows damn well if he were to ever do anything against the United States of America, his entire fucking country would be blown off the map in 3.2 seconds. He understands that damn well. But they make it seem like not only is he creating nukes, which he wasn't, but they think not only is he creating nukes, he's going to use them immediately. No, you made that up. You made both of those things up. So it's ridiculous no matter how you look at it. But understand, Megyn Kelly said very clearly, knowing what we know now, would you have authorized the invasion? Knowing what we know now, would you have authorized it? What we know now. And he said, I would have. Well, let me tell you some of the things that we know now, and then you tell me whether or not it's acceptable that anybody in the year 2015 who wants to be president can say something like that. Let me go through some numbers here, some facts, some inconvenient facts that people like Jeb Bush would like to brush over or ignore. 2.8 million people remain displaced or have fled Iraq because of the war. 2.8 million people. $5,000 is the amount of money that the United States spent in the Iraq War per second. $5,000 per second. $350,000 is the cost to deploy just one American military member.
whatever happened to fiscal discipline? You don't care about that, right? When it comes to war, you want to spend, doesn't matter how much you spend. Blank check, yay! Education, no blank check. Healthcare, no blank check. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Small government. War? Who gives a fuck? $350,000 to deploy one American military member. $490 billion is the amount in war benefits that's owed to our veterans. $490 billion with a B. $20 billion is the amount paid to KBR, the contractor responsible for equipment and services. And by the way, KBR is a subsidiary of Halliburton. Halliburton, who used to be one of the top guys at Halliburton? That's right, Dick Cheney. Funny how when he got out of power and he got an exit bonus, then he decided to give them a no-bid contract for a war that he started. Weird how that all worked out. We have $60 billion is the amount paid for reconstruction, which was ruled largely a waste due to corruption and shoddy work. We've covered that also on this show in detail. $12 billion is the cost per month of the war by the year 2008. Remember, all the neocons came out and told us when the invasion first happened, oh, we're going to be out of there real quick. It'll be like a few months or something, and then it'll be done, and the oil will pay for the war, and they'll greet us as liberators, and everything will go great. Really? How did that work out? $7 billion is the amount that's owed to Iraq by the U.S. after the war, mostly due to fraud. $20 billion is the annual air conditioning cost for the war. The air conditioning alone for the war is $20 billion. Where are the fiscal hawks? I don't hear you. Here's what's missing in Iraq. $546 million in spare parts. We just lost it. We don't know where it went. 190,000 guns. Because what could be bad about losing guns in a country that has sectarian war between Sunnis and Shias? American guns, 190,000 of them. Whoops, where'd they go? We lost them. Oh, look, they're being used to, the Sunnis and the Shias are using them to kill each other. That's wonderful. Including 110,000 AK-47s, by the way. So small things that they could all use. 40% is the increase in Iraq oil production. Oh, now we're getting to see what some of the spoils of the war are. So we fuck up your entire country and we kill all these people, but it's okay, don't worry, because we just increase oil production by 40%. So yay. $5 billion is the revenue from Iraqi oil in 2003. In 2011, you know what it jumped to? $85 billion. But no, oil did not factor into this decision for the war in any way. It wasn't even a small part. It was nothing. Even though in 2003, $5 billion was the revenue from Iraqi oil, now it's $85 billion. But it did, again, it didn't factor at all. Of course not. $150 billion is the amount that oil companies are expected to invest in oil development in Iraq over the next decade. That is, of course, if ISIS doesn't take over all the oil fields, which is very possible since we, of course, opened Pandora's box in that respect. $75 billion is the approximate amount expected to go to American subcontracting companies. Largest of all is Halliburton. Look that name again. Now we get to – I haven't even gotten to the most devastating numbers yet. That's how big of a fucking debacle Iraq was. I haven't even gotten to the worst numbers yet. You ready? $1.7 trillion is the amount in war expenses spent by the U.S. Treasury Department through fiscal year 2013. So just as of fiscal year 2013, $1.7 trillion is what we spent in for war costs. You ready for the what it's going to cost when all is said and done? The projected interest payments due by 2053, so the cost of the war by 2053 when you factor in with the money we borrowed for the war, $7 trillion. $7 trillion. We could have given every homeless person, every poor person, every middle-class person in America a decent living standard, universal health care, universal education, daycare. We could have fucking fixed the United States of America's infrastructure. We could have the number one infrastructure in the world by a mile. Nope, we just flush it down the toilet because we wanted to kill brown skin people in Iraq. $189,000, I'm sorry, not dollars. Now we get to the even worse part. The money's one thing, it gets worse, casualties. There were 189,000 direct war deaths, so casualties that were direct war deaths, which doesn't include the hundreds of thousands more that died due to war-related hardships. So that's the very conservative number, 189,000. There were 4,488 U.S. service personnel killed directly. So support the troops? I have an idea. Let's support the troops by not having 4,488 of them die for no goddamn reason in a dumbass war that shouldn't have happened in the first place. How about that? 32,223, that's troops that were injured, not including PTSD, because if you include PTSD, that goes up way more.
there were 655,000 people who died in Iraq since the invasion that would not have died if the invasion had not occurred. So, when you talk about deaths that the U.S. are directly responsible for, that we're directly responsible for, that number's, again, around 200,000. But then when you broaden that out to, well, how many people died because of the invasion that wouldn't have died because of the invasion, even though the U.S. didn't directly kill them, then that number's 655,000. And by the way, even that's a conservative number because there's a new report out that says it's about 2 million. And again, this gets into the Sunni-Shia conflict, the sectarian back and forth, which was contained until we went in there and we fucked everything up by de-bathifying the government. You know, we pissed off the Sunnis and we pissed off the Shias 14 different times because we meddled in the affairs and gave one person the power and then they oppressed the other people. And it was a perpetual cycle that increased the sectarian violence. So either we're responsible for about 200,000 deaths or between 655,000 and 2 million deaths. How does that weigh on our collective conscience as Americans, right? We pay for that. That's our money. That's our tax dollars that went to it. And Jeb Bush is dumb enough to say in 2015, yeah, no, I would have, well, rock and roll would have been a great idea. I would have done it too. Me and my brother are like this on this issue, man. Great, then step the fuck aside, son. You're not going to be president of the United States. How about that? And by the way, I saved one more number for you. You ready? Zero. What number is that? That's the number of nuclear weapons that were found in Iraq. So the entire premise was, well, Saddam did 9/11. That's why we need to go in. We found out that was complete bullshit. Not true at all. Nowhere near true. Every expert agrees. So that's bullshit. But then they said, well, he has weapons of mass destruction. He's going to use them. That's total bullshit because he had zero. And it's not like when we learned that he had zero a while ago and when we learned he didn't do 9/11 a while ago that we said, whoops, our bad, let's pull out and pay the Iraqis reparations for fucking up their entire country. No, no. We said, well, let's stay there a little longer. Why? I'll tell you why. Because it's not just about the things they said it was about. Of course not. I just went through the numbers with you. It was also about power and control and getting natural resources. And if you don't believe that, you're simply denying the facts. All right. You know what I like to call that, ladies and gentlemen? I like to call that substance. All right, now we go to Ben Carson. Ben Carson sat down with Chris Wallace of Fox News, and he honestly gave one of the most embarrassing political interviews I've ever seen.
You have compared our government today to Nazi Germany. Do you really believe that?
Well, a lot of people like to say that. But what I said is that in Nazi Germany, most of those people didn't believe in what Hitler was doing. But did they say anything? They did not. And that's what allowed things to progress to that point. We need to be willing to stand up and speak up for what we believe.
So Obama and Hitler
oppose Barack Obama all the time.
There are a lot of people in our society who are afraid to say what they really mean because they may get an IRS audit. People will call them names. Their job may be interfered with. This is not what America was supposed to be.
Okay. Here's what you said about Obamacare.
Obamacare is really, I think, the worst thing that has happened in this nation since slavery. And it is, in a way, it is slavery.
The worst things in slavery?
Well, you have to understand what I'm talking about.
We do, and you're dumb.
Obamacare fundamentally changes the relationship between the people and the government. The government is supposed to respond to the will of the people, not dictate to the people what they are doing.
Right.
And with this program, we're allowing that whole paradigm to be switched around.
Of course.
Finally, in the area of these remarks, just this week you said that the president must carry out a law passed by Congress, but you said he doesn't necessarily have to pass what you called a judicial law, which raises the question, do you believe that the president must observe a decision by the Supreme Court?
Well, what I said is that the president doesn't have to agree with it.
Well, of course not, but does he have to enforce it?
Well, Dred Scott, a perfect example. You know, the Supreme Court came up with this, and Abraham Lincoln did not agree with it. Now, admittedly, it caused a lot of conflict and eventually led to a civil war, but we're in a better place because of it.
But does the president have to carry out a Supreme Court rule?
The way our Constitution is set up, the president or the executive branch is obligated to carry out the laws of the land. The laws of the land, according to our Constitution, are provided by the legislative branch.
But sir,
the laws of the land are not provided by the judiciary branch.
But, sir, so, since Marbury v. Madison in 1803, we have lived under the principle of judicial review, which says if the Supreme Court says this is the law, this is constitutional, that the rest, the executive has to observe that.
And I have said this is an area that we need to discuss. We need to get into a discussion of this because it has changed from the original intent. And
you're saying this is an open question as far as you're concerned.
It is an open question. It needs to be discussed.
Marbury versus Madison needs to be discussed. It's still up for debate. We haven't, you know, we haven't settled into that one yet. The early 1800s was like super recently. Judicial review is still up for debate, according to Ben Carson. So you basically nullify the entire history of the Supreme Court if you eliminate judicial review. The Supreme Court, just forget it. It's not even, it's not like a co-equal branch of government anymore. It's just for the Supreme Court, Supreme Court, get it out of here. We don't care about it. It's irrelevant. Judicial review is nonsense. Okay, understand how stupid that is. Without judicial review, we would be, for example, giving the death penalty to children. It took judicial review to step in and say, you know, we think that's cruel and unusual punishment to, like, kill 14-year-olds if they commit a crime. Just saying. Okay, that's out the window, and states can do that if they so please if we get rid of judicial review. How about how this would affect the First Amendment? Well, there were, you know, state laws and local laws against speech, against free speech, like flag burning, for example. So it would be illegal to burn flags in some states if the Supreme Court didn't have the ability to do judicial review. Because they reviewed these laws and determined whether or not they were constitutional and said, yeah, you know, that's unconstitutional to block people from doing their free speech and burning flags, for example, or putting signs on their lawn that have political messages. There are some places that have, you know, laws that say you can't have any yard signs, and somebody would put up a yard sign with a political message, and they'd say, nope, you got to take it down. Well, the Supreme Court said, no, they don't. That's their property, their decision. It's freedom of speech. Back the fuck off. Or how about, I don't know, maybe the fact that the president would be able to do whatever the president wants, like a dictator, and have no check on him whatsoever? Have you thought about that? That's what judicial review is there for. Remember the Nixon moment? If the president does it, it's not illegal. The Supreme Court was like, ha-ha, bitch, yes it is. That's what we're here for, to determine whether or not you are abiding by the Constitution. Or how about fucking Brown versus Board of Education, which is the case that you know, desegregated the schools. Without judicial review, that wouldn't have happened. No, eliminated, Ben Carson. You're too stupid. You don't know what you're talking about on these issues. How the fuck are you a neurosurgeon? I mean, when it comes to politics, he's like, I don't know, I'll just say some shit. It's true enough, even though it's not, but I'll just say it, and it is what it is. Dude, when you were a neurosurgeon, what did you have to do in order to be a neurosurgeon? You needed pinpoint precision, and you needed to know everything that was going on inside of a brain, and you need to know everything about the neurons and the synapses and the way it worked, right? How can you figure all that out, but you can't figure out the basics of the Supreme Court in the United States of America, or just the basics of how our country works? How do you not know that? It's so embarrassing, man. And then even earlier on, so when Chris Wallace was like, you know, you compared America to Nazi Germany, he was like, yeah, that's right. You know, Obama's like Hitler. You know, I said that people in Nazi Germany, they didn't all agree with Hitler, but they just sat by idly. His point is, I mean, look, Obama, for example, people are sitting by idly. But you're comparing Obama to Hitler. Hitler shoved people in gas chambers and killed them in a genocide. Obama gave them health care. You can't make that comparison. He says, Obamacare is like slavery. Yeah, that's totally reasonable. That's what he's saying to Chris Wallace. I don't see the problem here. It's totally reasonable.
He said, and the reason why is it's like slavery because the government is supposed to respond to the will of the people. The government can't dictate to the people what to do. First of all, laws, by definition, are that. There's a law against murder. That's the government telling the people you can't murder. Are you against that law? So you're making an argument against all laws. That doesn't make any sense. But by the way, if you want to go down this road of, but the government's supposed to do what the people wants. Sign me up, son, and we'll have a totally progressive country if you do that. The minimum wage would be increased. We'd be out of all these stupid wars overseas. And by the way, a recent poll found 51% of the American people want a single-payer system, a more liberal healthcare system, a socialist healthcare system. So there you are arguing that Obamacare is so bad. Why don't they just do what the American people want? Let's shake on it right now. I agree. Then we'll have a more liberal system. We'll have a single-payer system. But this is the thing about Ben Carson. It's too easy. It's too easy. He makes my job way too easy. He just says things that are really, really, you know, demonstrably untrue. They're factually incorrect. And then we just have to come out here and say, wrong, 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 and here's why it's wrong. So he's just, honestly, he's just political fodder in this race for people like me. And Chris Wallace actually, I can't believe I'm saying this, but for a Fox News host, decent fucking job there, dude. And that shows you how weak of a candidate Ben Carson is and how little he knows about politics. Is that, albeit the best Fox News host, but a Fox News host nonetheless, just questioned you a little bit, and it all came crumbling down, and you look like the clown that you are. All right, real quick, one more on Ben Carson, then we'll take our next break. Ben Carson was asked about his tax policy by Chris Wallace and specifically how it hurts the poor. Take a look.
One of the pillars of your economic program is a flat tax. How would that work?
Well, I like the idea of a proportional tax. That way you pay according to your ability. And I got that idea, quite frankly, from the Bible, tithing. You make $10 billion a year, you pay $1 billion. You make $10 a year, you pay $1. You get the same rights. That's pretty darn fair if you ask me. Now, some people say it's not fair because, you know, the poor people can't afford to pay that dollar. That's very condescending. You know, I grew up very poor. I've experienced every economic level. And I can tell you that poor people have pride, too, and they don't want to be just taken care of. And also, if everybody is paying, it makes it very difficult for these politicians to come along and raise taxes. It's easy to raise it on 1% or 2% or 5%. It's very difficult to raise it on 100%.
But, Doctor, here is the problem with a flat tax in the real world. According to the Tax Policy Center, to raise the same amount of revenue we do now, the tax rate would have to be in the low to mid 20% range.
Wrong.
Low and middle income families would get a big tax hike, while wealthy families would actually get a big tax cut.
That's actually not, I don't agree with that assessment. Let me put it that way.
Awesome. He's like, okay, so here we have a study from economists and experts, and it says X. I disagree. Oh, really? Do you? Well, let me ask you a question, Ben. Is that how it works when you do brain surgery, too? When you're sitting and listening to your professor, and your professor's like, you know, according to experts, the proper way to do this kind of surgery is you make the incision at this point right here. Professor, I disagree. It doesn't fucking matter if you disagree. They're the guys with the data. They're the guys who did the studies. And he goes on to say, well, I have my own experts. Really? Name them. Bupkis, he can't name them. Meanwhile, Chris Wallace is like, okay, Tax Policy Center. They did a study, they found this. I disagree. It doesn't matter if you disagree, dude. It's irrelevant. And look, the criticisms they made are absolutely true in that study. They said you need a higher rate than you think, and this actually disproportionately hurts the poor. Think about it. If, let's say the number, just to be kind to Ben Carson here, even though the percentage would be in the 20-some-odd percentile range, let's say it was 12%. He gets a 12% flat tax rate. Taking 12% of the money of somebody who earns $30,000 a year, that fucking hurts. You know, they might not be able to afford housing or food or to pay the fucking light bill. There's a lot of – that's
you know, you can't, it's hard to raise a family on that money, especially if the government takes 12% of that. But 12% of somebody who makes $8 million a year is nothing. You won't even fucking realize it's gone. It'll show up in your statement, but you won't feel it. You've got the exact same kind of lifestyle. So, yeah, it is. It does suck for the poor if you do that. And I love the argument he made where he said, well, the reason I like the flat tax is because it makes it difficult to raise taxes on 100% of people. But no. But, Ben, the flat tax in and of itself is you raising taxes on the poor and the middle class. So essentially what you're saying is, I'm so concerned about raising taxes on the American people that I will first raise taxes on the American people, and then I will be concerned about it after I raise taxes on them. But you're the problem. You're the problem. You're the one that wants to raise it on the middle class and the poor. And this goes back to something we talk about all the time on this show. The Republicans aren't the party of tax cuts. They're not. The Republicans, when they talk about tax cuts, they're talking for either 1% of the population, depending on which Republican you refer to, either 1% of them, 5% of them, at most 10% of them. The Democrats cut taxes more for 90% of the American people. He's telling you right there, I want whatever the flat tax, 10% flat tax rate or a little higher than that or whatever. Okay, so if you make, you know, whatever the number is, $50,000 or less, you are getting a tax hike. So he's increasing taxes for a majority of the American people as he claims, I'm the guy that's going to cut your taxes. But you just told us you're going to increase the taxes. No, the flat tax is a horrible idea. It totally hurts the poor and the middle class in a disproportionate way. And Chris Walsh even goes on to say in that segment, under this system, the rich get away like bandits. Again, when you get to a place where you're even making a Fox News host say you want the rich to get away like bandits, you know that policy is beyond stupid. Okay. All right, let's take a final break here. When we come back, I got more Ben Carson, and I just got a whole bunch of great stuff, man. Michelle Obama on racism, got psychologists talking about porn addiction and video game addiction. Stay right there. Don't go anywhere. We're back. Quick breaks. I got a lot of stuff to get to here. God damn it. I got one more Ben Carson. Ben Carson sat down with CNBC, and he was asked about his gay marriage stance, and it got weird.
One passage in your book where you were talking about gay marriage, and you said, I believe
in the traditional definition of marriage, and that no group has the right to change that. How do you walk into this arena and manage that?
Recognize that if you change the definition of marriage for one group, what do you say to the next group?
What is the next group?
Do you say, well, we changed it for this group, but that's it. We're not changing it for anybody else. Does that seem fair?
Well, but what other groups are there?
There are more groups, I guarantee you.
But like,
I think you know that there are more groups. Yep. Everybody knows there are more groups.
Honest to God, I don't know what you're talking about.
Other variations on traditional marriage? You don't think there's any others?
You mean like bigamy or something?
That's
a possibility.
That's possible. Why would you stop with one group being able to change it and then say for the next group you can't change it?
I'm not advocating either way. I'm just saying
I'm just asking the question.
Ben Carson is hilarious because he oftentimes makes really dumb points, but he thinks that he's nailing it. And he has this look on his face like, oh, I got you now. I just destroyed you. No, you made yourself look like a clown. He's like, well, why would we allow traditional marriage? Because then they're not going to – why would we allow gay marriage? Because then we're not going to stop there. They're just going to go on and ask for more rights, like, you know, the people who want to do polygamy. How dare they want to get married? Yeah, I have no problem with polygamous relationships. You want to know why? Because I'm not a child. It's none of my business. Now, it's a different story if you talk about, well, they're just doing it as, like, this scam, or it's for fraud to get more tax breaks or whatever and scam the government. Well, in that case, yeah, you crack down on the abuse and you crack down on fraud and stuff like that. You don't allow that. But if somebody really wants to get married in a polygamous way, whether it's a guy marrying a bunch of women or a woman marrying a bunch of men or a man or a woman marrying men and women, I don't give a flying fuck. It's none of my goddamn business. I'm an adult. It's got nothing to do with me. So if they're peaceful and they're doing their thing over there and they want to get married, by all means, go ahead. But in his mind, he's like, aha, I got you. What, do you want to, like, treat other people equally too? Gross. What's so sad about guys like Ben Carson is they're prisoners to their generation, right? Whatever the situation looks like in their lives, they think, this is it. We have to have it right because I'm living at this point in time. So everything from when I was a kid, it should stay this way. It should stay with, well, you know, thankfully, I'm black, and thankfully black people got their rights, so that's good. But anybody else getting rights, no, we need to stop that. Because that's what it's like right now, and we just got to keep it this way because what we have is perfect because we're living in this right now. Stop being, you know, a prisoner to your own culture. You have to break free. Just because we do it this way doesn't mean it is by definition right that we do it this way. We can continue to progress and we can continue to make improvements and we can get a better system where we treat more people equally. Now, of course, Ben Carson in the past has also lumped in pedophilia and bestiality into this conversation as well. No, Ben. There's a huge difference between gay marriage and polygamy. I think both of those are totally fine because it's consenting adults, and bestiality and pedophilia. First of all, you have to have a standard when you determine who you let marry and not, and who gets equal rights and who, you know, what is still considered criminal. And the standard that makes sense to me, because the only rational one I can come up with, is consenting adults. So, first of all, there needs to be consent. So, sorry, bestiality, you're gone, right? You don't know. How do you know if you're fucking a dolphin that the dolphin wants it? You don't know. That's not true when people say, yeah, the goat wanted me to shove my dick in its ass. You don't know. So that there's no consent there, so that doesn't count. And pedophilia, again, I said consenting adults. Children, by definition, cannot consent because they're at an age where they don't know what sex is. They haven't reached puberty. They haven't developed in that way as a human being yet. So you can't ask them to make a decision as an adult because they're not an adult. They're not sexually mature yet. So pedophilia is going to remain illegal, and it should. Bestiality, same thing. But for gay marriage and polygamy, yes, they're consenting adults. They should be able to do whatever they want to do, and that's a standard that makes sense. But see, to Ben Carson, this is the way he thinks. We should make the decision on marriage based on religion, number one.
already wrong and gone out of the conversation, because the whole point of the United States of America is to make it so that religion does not dictate our laws. And you want to make religion dictate our laws. So you're wrong on that one. You can't use that standard. And the other standard he has is just this. You ready? It's my opinion. It's my opinion that we should keep rights away from gay people, so let's do that. That's not an argument. It's not, oh, I like it this way, so let's keep it that way. No. But nobody's forcing you to get gay married. It's just Ken and Steve down the street are saying, hey, we are consenting adults and we want to get gay married. You got nothing to do with us, so stay the fuck over there. We're going to do what we want to do. So nobody's forcing you to do it. Other people are just saying, let us do it. So for you to just say, well, it's my opinion that they shouldn't get married, fuck your opinion. Who cares about your opinion? What about their opinions? How about that? They're consenting adults and they're not hurting anybody. So yet again, Ben Carson thinks he's nailing it, but he's getting everything comically wrong. All right, now we go to Mike Huckabee. Mike Huckabee was called out last week for pushing a fake cancer cure with his email advertising system. And this week, he went on Face the Nation and defended doing a different kind of fake cure, this time for diabetes.
Governor, let me ask you, Ron Fournier of National Journal, who will be on this broadcast later today, writes that while you are talking as a populist, a blue-collar populist, you have lent your name for money to questionable products, and he points out that an infomercial you made for a diabetes cure is simply not supported by the medical community. What about that?
Well, there's going to be a lot of criticism thrown my way. One of the things that I have said is that the particular plan you're talking about is about the healthy eating, watching the kind of foods one takes in, and, you know, I don't have to defend everything that I've ever done. I'm not doing those infomercials, obviously, now as a candidate for president. But if that's the worst thing somebody can say to me is that I advocated for people who have diabetes to do something to reverse it and stop the incredible pain of that, then I'm going to be a heck of a good president.
Well, Governor, I have diabetes, and I agree with you, and most doctors will tell you, you have to lose weight, you have to have a nutritious diet, but you were also selling pills of some sort, were you not?
No, there was not.
That's
a misnomer.
No, it's not.
One of the elements of the plan was dietary supplements, but it's not the fundamental thing. The fundamental thing is always, as you and I both know, it's exercise. It's good eating habits. It's maintaining sugar levels. It's not eating a bunch of junk food, processed food, lots of carbs, sugar, those type of things. It's, as somebody might say, it's not rocket science, or as some might say, it ain't rocket surgery. It's really pretty simple, but it does require some discipline, and it's one of the four big things that are costing Americans in the healthcare system, along with cancer, Alzheimer's, and heart disease. If we approach this, as I have suggested, which is looking for cures rather than just treatment, we then not only save lives, we start saving serious money. And that's one of the reforms we need to be talking about nationally.
All right. Well, Governor, we'll be talking to you again down the line. And now you're out on the campaign trail officially. Thanks for joining us.
No. Bob Schieffer, you did a terrible job. Okay, your job is to press him on that issue. Have your facts in front of you. Part of the cure for diabetes was cinnamon. Cinnamon. You didn't know that going into the conversation? You couldn't press him on that more? Now, Jake Tapper the other day did this kind of with his bogus cancer cure, which he also pushed through his email system. And Jake Tapper was a little bit harder than Bob Schieffer, but at the end of both of those interviews, they're like, all right, Mike, we'll talk to you soon. Have a good one. No. This guy is lucky he's not in jail. That's the conversation you should bring up to him. Right to his face, you should say, you know, do you realize how dangerous what you did is? You sent out emails that said a part of curing cancer is a Bible verse. That's not
true. If even one person decided to stop their chemo and their radiation because they're a fan of Mike Huckabee and they trust Mike Huckabee, and Mike Huckabee says, read this Bible verse and have some frankincense or myrrh extract, which was part of it, and everything will be good. Well, you should be in jail if that's the case, if one person listened. No, the people who follow Mike Huckabee are not that bright to begin with, and they trust him. So if he's doing some snake oil salesman shit where he's scamming people for money, which is exactly what happened here, and he's pushing a cancer cure that's not a cancer cure, I don't see how that's not a crime. Imagine a pharmaceutical company ran an ad for a pill that they said cured cancer, and it didn't cure cancer. There was no evidence it cured cancer, and people started taking that and dying because it didn't cure cancer. They stopped their chemo and they took the pill. What would happen? The pharmaceutical company would either be put out of business or they'd get like a multi-billion-dollar fine. Even with the pharmaceutical companies having bought the government, which they did, there would still be a crackdown on that. But Mike Huckabee does it, and all of a sudden you can have casual, chatty conversations with him about him running for president, and you end on a jovial note. No, son, you're done. Step aside. You should be investigated for the shit that you did. This is unacceptable. Again, you said a Bible verse cures cancer. You said cinnamon cures diabetes. If the media cannot crack down and drop the hammer on Huckabee over this, you can get away with anything if you're part of the elite, if you're part of the establishment, and if you just put a fucking smile on your face and smooth talk everybody over. The guy pushed a bogus cancer cure. That's a scam artist. He pushed a bogus diabetes cure. That's a scam artist. There's no open questions here. There's no, well, what's your opinion on this? Doctors and experts say he pushed these things that are not cures as if they were cures. You don't get to come back from that. You don't get to come back from that. Again, not only should you not be in the running to be a president of the United States of America, you should be fucking thanking your lucky stars that you're not in jail. All right, let's move on here. Go to Glenn Greenwald. Glenn Greenwald of The Intercept had a fantastic article exposing some pretty brazen hypocrisy in the Canadian government. Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper on January 8th, 2015, said this about the Charlie Hebdo shootings. Quote, "When a trio of hooded men struck at some of our most cherished democratic principles, freedom of expression, freedom of the press, they assaulted democracy everywhere. They have declared war on anybody who does not think and act exactly as they wish they would think and act. They have declared war on any country, like ourselves, that values freedom, openness, and tolerance." So all of that, I think, is spot on. I agree with it 100%, and I actually think he nailed it. But here's the problem. From CBC Today, quote, "Ottawa threatening hate charges against those who boycott Israel. The Harper government is signaling its intention to use hate crime laws against Canadian advocacy groups that encourage boycotts of Israel. Such a move could target a range of civil society organizations from the United Church of Canada and the Canadian Quakers to campus protest groups and labor unions." So, in other words, free speech means that you can offend Muslims, no problem. And again, I agree with that 100%. In fact, I enjoy doing that. But according to this idiot and the Canadian government, mean offending supporters of Israel by agreeing with the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. That's only the clearest example of hypocrisy I've ever seen in my life. So you're going to crack down on people. You're going to use hate crimes laws and go after people if they want to do sanctions against Israel, but you're going to cheer on people for mocking Muhammad in cartoon fashion. Look, again, I want to be clear. I agree with mocking Muhammad in cartoon fashion. Go for it all day, and I'll defend you to death. I've been doing it. I've been defending right-wing assholes over that. But you guys are fucking brazen hypocrites because you're flipping when it comes to, speaking out against Israel. All of a sudden, free speech is out the window. So Glenn Greenwald breaks this down very well. He says, quote, "Has a JSWE BDS, that's the boycott, divestment, sanction thing, hashtag started trending on Twitter? Under the new Charlie Hebdo standard, it's not enough to defend free speech. One must praise and even express the speech targeted with suppression. Have all of the newfound free speech crusaders begun organizing pro-Israel boycott rallies in order to defy these suppression efforts? Stephen Harper is the perfect poster boy for how free expression is tribalistically manipulated and exploited in the West. when the views being suppressed are ones amenable to those in power, like cartoons mocking Islam, free speech is venerated. But when ideas are advocated that upset those in power, the very same people acquiesce to or expressly endorse full-scale suppression. Thus, can the Canadian Prime Minister pompously parade around as some sort of guardian of Enlightenment ideals, only 3 months later, to act like the classic tyrant? As I've argued many times, all applications of hate speech laws are inherently tyrannical, dangerous, and wrong, and it's truly mystifying that people convince themselves that their beliefs are so sacrosanct that it should be illegal to question or dissent from them. But independent of that, what we see here again is the utter foolishness of endorsing such laws on pragmatic grounds. They will inevitably be used against not just the ideas you hate, but ones you like. And when that happens, if you cheered when such laws were used to suppress the ideas you hate, then you will have no valid grounds to object. Glenn Greenwald is 100% correct, and this is something that I tried to repeatedly bring up when talking about Pam Geller and her group that was doing the Mock Muhammad cartoon contest. I said, look, 100%, you have to stand up for their right to do it, and you don't bend on that an inch, okay? But also understand, you're allowed to disagree with Pam Geller on everything else. All of her political stances, all of her the other comments she's made about Obama being a Manchurian candidate and a Muslim himself, and she's against a UN resolution that would condemn the killing of Muslims in Burma. Apparently she sees no problem with that, and she does view this as some sort of a holy war, and she wants to make it into a holy war. So you're allowed to agree on the principle of free speech 100%, but then at the same time say, look, but you are an idiot and a dunce and a fucking hypocrite, man. And you're going to see this all over the place. You're going to see a bunch of people who were standing up cheering for free speech in one area, all of a sudden in another area, they're like, no, free speech, I'm not sure about that. I like Israel, I'm on the side of Israel, so I can't really disagree with the way that these hate crimes laws are being implemented. Well, you fucking should. Everybody who stood up, rightfully so, by the way, and said, I'm defending the right-wing kooks today because they were shot for free speech. Everybody who did that, first of all, good on you for doing that in that case. But now you have to stand up and make the exact same fucking argument in this case. Even if you agree with Israel 100% and you don't agree with the Palestinians at all, you have to stand up and say, no, you don't fucking go after these people with the law. You don't try to do hate crimes and crack down on them for speaking out against Israel in an open society, in a free speech, free protest kind of way. So everybody who stood up on the side of, yes, mock Muhammad in the cartoons, stand up now and say the same thing. Yes, call for those the boycott of Israel, if you so please. The law should not come after you in any way, shape, or form. And by the way, in conclusion here real fast, let me just add this to increase my vulnerability on this topic. I totally agree with the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement against Israel. To try to shut down even conversation about it with law proves that you're on the losing side of that argument. You can't win in that argument with logic and reason because we're right. So what do you have to do? Don't even allow them to talk about it or say it. I don't see any other – how else are you going to get peace in that region in the Middle East? I mean, we spoke about it before, but the Palestinians proposed a perfect peace deal through Jordan. They said, let's do the 1967 borders. Let's build a giant wall. Let's split up Jerusalem. Let's take a year to iron out all the details. We'll sit down together and do that, and then we'll implement this all in like 5 years' time or whatever the final number was. And Israel rejected it out of hand. Not even going to consider it. And if anybody else considers it, you're an anti-Semite. That's the argument they made. So if we're not – that is the compromise border, 1967. So if Israel rejects that, and they're the ones that have more guns and more power, right, how else are we going to get a two-state solution? How else are we going to get a Palestinian state? Israel has a state they're internationally recognized, and they are blocking the Palestinian state from coming into existence. In my opinion, you obviously need to do – a boycott, divestments, and sanctions. And by the way, I would argue that makes me more pro-Israel than the other guys because I'm looking for peace for Israel in the long run, right? They're just looking, we just want to crush the Palestinians more right now. Well, I'm sorry, but the polls show it. You are making Hamas more popular. Benjamin Netanyahu is Hamas's best friend. Because after he did the crackdown where he killed thousands of people, including 60 to 80% civilians in the recent incursion into Gaza, the polls showed Hamas got way more popular. So I would, if you support that movement, I think it's more pro-Israel, because then you're trying to get a two-state solution and you're trying to get long-term peace. So, but again, to digress from that, the overall point here is, and it's very important, let's wait for it, but I hope that the same people who were saying, free speech, man, you get to mock Muhammad all you want, I'm going to wait for them to come out and say, yeah, you get to call for boycotts all day long and the Canadian government should not crack down on those people. I'll wait for it. For some reason, I don't think all the people who were screaming that it's okay to mock Muhammad are going to say it's okay to call for boycotts of Israel. All right, let's go to Michelle Obama. Michelle Obama gave a fantastic speech on race at Tuskegee University. Let's listen to a portion of it.
The road ahead is not going to be easy. It never is, especially for folks like you and me. Because while we've come so far, the truth is that those age-old problems are stubborn. And they haven't fully gone away. So there will be times, just like for those airmen, when you feel like folks look right past you, or they see just a fraction of who you really are. The world won't always see you in those caps and gowns. They won't know how hard you worked and how much you sacrificed to make it to this day. The countless hours you spent studying to get this diploma. The multiple jobs you worked to pay for school, the times you had to drive home and take care of your grandma, the evenings you gave up to volunteer at a food bank or organize a campus fundraiser, they don't know that part of you. Instead, they will make assumptions about who they think you are based on their limited notion of the world. And my husband and I know how frustrating that experience can be. We both felt the sting of those daily slights throughout our entire lives. The folks who crossed the street in fear of their safety. The clerks who kept a close eye on us in all those department stores. The people at formal events who assumed we were the help. And those who have questioned our intelligence, our honesty, even our love of this country. And I know that these little indignities are obviously nothing compared to what folks across the country are dealing with every single day. Those nagging worries that you're going to get stopped or pulled over for absolutely no reason. The fear that your job application will be overlooked because of the way your name sounds. The agony of sending your kids to schools that may no longer be separate but are far from equal. The realization that no matter how far you rise in life, how hard you work to be a good person, a good parent, a good citizen, for some folks, it will never be enough. And all of that is going to be a heavy burden to carry. It can feel isolating. It can make you feel like your life somehow doesn't matter. That you're like the invisible man that Tuskegee grad Ralph Ellison wrote about all those years ago. And as we've seen over the past few years, those feelings are real. They're rooted in decades of structural challenges that have made too many folks feel frustrated and invisible. And those feelings are playing out in communities like Baltimore and Ferguson and so many others across this country. But graduates, today, I want to be very clear that those feelings are not an excuse to just throw up our hands and give up. Not an excuse. They are not an excuse to lose hope.
Yeah, I love everything about that speech. Because it wasn't even just, so she gave all of the facts about, racism, and she can explain in great detail that she understands exactly what it's like to grow up being black in America. But then she even ended it with a message that conservatives should love, right? The message at the end was her saying, even with all the horrible circumstances and the facts of reality and the history we're dealing with here in America, essentially, you can still do it, right? It's not an excuse. You can find a way. You're smart enough. You're strong enough. You're bright enough. You're brilliant enough. You work hard enough. You got this. You can do it. So you would think conservatives would be like, oh, at least she ended it exactly how we wanted her to end it. Yes, yes. Nope, of course not. I think it was Raw Story. They had an article earlier today, conservatives on Twitter just going balls to the wall, fucking bonkers, going crazy. I love how any time a black person in America acknowledges the fact that race exists and that they have personal stories of racism in their own lives, they get called racist. If you discuss racism in any way that doesn't agree with the conservative take that reverse racism is worse, you're a racist. If you even say race as a liberal, you're racist. They try to flip it. This has been their argument forever. They do it with gay marriage, right? If you support gay marriage, you're the bigot for not accepting me being a bigot. They flip the history on its head. They flip the reality on its head. And here's the thing, man, and this is the point we've been trying to make for the longest time on Secular Talk. There are just flat-out empirical facts about racism that you can't override because your opinion is different. So, for example, and she alluded to it there, the resume study. So if you have all the same work information and one name sounds white and one name sounds black, the white name gets 50% more callbacks. That's outside of like, oh, just by random chance. That's outside of that realm. In other words, what that means is, subconsciously or not, people who hire go, I trust the white name more than the black name, so I'll give this person the job, even though the work experience is exactly the same. There's no other way to explain that other than race. If you try to deny that race is involved in that, you're an idiot. I want to be kind to you. I want to be nice to you, but you're just shoving your head directly up your anus. And I can't help you if you look at something like that and go, no, I don't see race as an issue here. Okay, then go, you know, suck Rush Limbaugh's dick a little more and see where that gets you in life. Another example, disparity in the enforcement of drug laws. So studies have shown that black people and white people use drugs at a very similar rate, but black people get arrested 4 times more often for using drugs. Again, race is the only way to explain that. How about selling drugs? White people sell more drugs in America. Black people get arrested more for selling drugs. No other way to explain that. One community is policed much more than the other community. Another great example, the online sales study. When you have the same product, same price, one black hand holding the product, one white hand holding the product, which one gets picked more? The white hand, of course. And there was even the YouTube car study where a white guy tried to like break into his own car. Nobody cared. Everybody walked by. Police even drove by, didn't care. When his black friend tried to do it, immediately the cop showed up, put him in cuffs, and they were rough with him. This is the problem. Racism does still exist, whether or not people want to acknowledge it. I mean, imagine it. Let me try to sum it up as quickly as I can here because I'm running out of time. I can hear the countdown in my ear, but
60 seconds.
If you make it and you're successful and you're a black person, what happens oftentimes in the white community? We know. We've heard it a trillion times. Ah, affirmative action is the only reason he made it. We heard about Obama. They said that about Obama. Ah, affirmative action is the only reason. That's why the black person's successful. Always affirmative action. But if a black person doesn't make it, they go, ah, typical. You know how they are. They're lazy. They don't work hard. They're part of that gangsta culture. So wait a second. If they make it, you hold it against them and say, just affirmative action. If they don't make it, you hold it against them and say, ah, typical, thug, what's going on here? So it's a lose-lose for them. So maybe you should get your understanding of the situation in perspective and realize that you have a bias against black people if that's the way you think. All right, guys, I'm out of time. Kisses, smooches. We'll see you tomorrow. Same time, same place. Peace.